Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the program, the scramble over homeless shelter sites and an apparent disconnect between the mayors of Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County on the issue. Also, a shortage of affordable housing in the state. Local climate scientists worry about their future under a Trump administration. And an industry leader calls on the outdoor retailer convention to leave town to protest Utah's stance on public lands. Joining me for this discussion, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Roger.
Salt Lake Tribune environment reporter Emma Penrod is here. Good morning, Emma.
Morning.
Columnist Paul Raleigh, thanks once again to you for being here, and good morning to you.
Good morning.
And joining us via the phone from the Capitol, reporter Matt Piper is with us. Hello, Matt, and welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks very much for being here. Listeners, a reminder to our listeners that you are invited to participate in this Friday morning news wrap-up. Your questions and comments are welcome. Post them at sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Let's start with a story that has dominated the Trib's headlines this past week. The kind of difficulties the city is facing, the pushback on its plan for new homeless shelter sites. Matt Piper, there are four locations for these new homeless resource centers, and the plan is just to put 150 beds in each of those. The brunt of the pushback that I just mentioned has centered around one of those sites, the shelter site on Simpson Avenue in the Sugar House neighborhood. Tell us about what's happening with that site right now.
Yeah, so that site is, of the four sites, by far the most residential. It abuts Green Street there, which has a bunch of single-family homes. And so in the weeks that have followed the site announcement, some nearby residents and some business owners have expressed at various public meetings that they'd like to see a site elsewhere or at least not there. And that has resonated at least with City Council member Lisa Adams, whose district that is, and she's proposed having just three sites and eliminating that one. City member Erin Mendenhall also said that she would like to see a site elsewhere. Her district is just a few blocks away. And the latest is sort of that that earlier this week, County Mayor Ben McAdams said that he told Mayor Biskupski that he'd like to see maybe an affordable housing project at that site, and that he would not favor reimbursing the city with state funding for the $7 million purchase of that land.
Yeah, $7 million was kind of a high price tag. It was one of the complaints that Ben McAdams had. And yeah, he suggested this alternative affordable housing there at that site, something that I think has appealed also to the council members that you mentioned, Lisa Ramsey Adams and Erin Mendenhall. A quick question about them. Were they on board with this site as a homeless shelter site when the original announcement happened? And then why the sort of change of decision there? Why the change of heart?
That's a good question. Erin Mendenhall says that she was not on board with the 653 Simpson site at any point, and that during her discussions, they never really met as a body. They kind of had small group discussions. A number of council members were out of town, and I think that they all sort of met separately or in small groups with the mayor and the administration. But she said that what she'd asked for was a heads up for the nearby residents at the very least, and maybe some sort of compensation for their loss in property value. And she has always said that she would not have voted for a sort of ceremonial resolution in support of the site selection, which was ultimately the city administration's decision to make. Whereas Lisa Adams has said that she would not have voted for it, but she said that weeks after the fact, I guess we'll never know what might have happened there, and that she has just heard simply the voices of her constituents, and that they have had the opportunity at public meetings to express their concerns,
right.
and they made an impact on her.
Well, and I know that Mayor Jackie Biskupski got an earful from residents at a meeting on Wednesday evening. Essentially, as you said, the message for many residents was, we don't want it in this neighborhood. Is the city, you know, you mentioned Ben McAdams, Mayor Ben McAdams from the county, suggesting that this be converted into an affordable housing site. Is that something that the city is now considering?
Jackie Biskupski said yesterday that she is not actively considering that at this point. But she did say, and this was a little bit of news that was sort of buried in my story, I suppose, today, that that the city purchased more than just the land that it needs for the shelter at that site. So on the north side of the street, they have what's I think most known for the daycare there, but you know, facilities for four businesses that currently lease the land,
right,
and property. And then there across the street on the south side, the city bought more than half the acreage for that $7 million that they paid. And the plans for that land are still unknown, but Mayor Biskupski said that she might consider having affordable housing there in addition to a shelter site.
Okay. I want to quickly remind our listeners that you can join this conversation with your comments and questions. The city's new strategy on homelessness, the outreach that they're doing now. Tell us your thoughts. The number to call, 801-355-8255. Another part of the apparent rift between Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams and Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski has to do with the site of the current shelter at the Road Home Shelter. Tell us about that, Matt.
Yeah, so I guess it's sort of one of those interesting arguments, because what they always say is we all agree that we eventually want to close the Road Home Shelter. And, we've heard time and time again that everyone's in agreement on that. But there is obviously a disagreement. And what that is sort of how much do you commit to closing that shelter, which everyone says is aging, and it represents an old service model. How do you commit to closing that, or what do you commit to closing that when the other four sites come online? And Mayor McAdams has said, kind of in response to homeless service providers and the state raising concerns that, well, there are fewer beds at these new facilities, so, you know, are we going to be putting people out in the cold? So that he said repeatedly since late summer, no, you know, we can keep the Road Home Shelter open as long as we need to. And that question has been answered a little bit differently from Mayor Biskupski. She has said that, you know, the county and the state need to take on some of this burden. And the whole idea behind doing this was that shelter has too many people, and it can't serve all of them. And Salt Lake City is carrying too large a portion of the state's burden with homelessness. So
right,
she would like to see what she calls a safety net somewhere else in the county, and to close the Road Home Shelter immediately upon the opening of the four new sites.
And that sounds, I mean, essentially that sounds like the big difference between the city and the county is that for the city, the idea of these new shelters was partially to close the old shelter, and the county is saying, no, this is a little bit different than that. Paul Raleigh, I want to bring you in on this, and Matt, hold the phone for just a moment. I know you've got some news to cover, but I'll if you don't mind hanging on just a few more minutes. Paul, this is sort of a difference that Mayor Jackie Biskupski is talking about, a new sort of safety net somewhere else. I'm assuming this would be a new safety net somewhere else to make up for the Road Home, closing the Road Home shelter. Meanwhile, big difference of opinion from Salt Lake County. I guess, what do you make of it, Paul?
Well, one of the allegations is that, you know, her wish to close it as soon as possible is a bone to the developers who are, you know, itching to develop that area. And Ben McAdams has said you need to keep that there, you know, a longer period of time to have a safety net down there. And plus, you've got all those services down there, the 4th Street Clinic and everything else. And, you know, there is that Pioneer Park Coalition, which is basically a group of developers who want to use that for, you know, develop housing and multi-use projects and get rid of the homeless shelter. The other issue is, and I've written about it, and so our reporters, we've had several stories about the issue of the existing businesses down there are just getting killed, being in that proximity of the road home. And, I wrote about the Rio Grande Cafe and all the problems that he has had with the homeless people bugging his customers, and he's lost a lot of business. And so there's that issue, too. But Ben McAdams, Ben McAdams is real big on low-income housing, and that's been one of his big issues. And he'd like to see more of that developed and then keep that there as a safety net a little longer.
Well, I want to get to that, too. I mean, there's a report on low-income housing or the lack of affordable housing across the state of Utah, and we will get there in a little bit. But something that still seems very much up in the air here is funding for the expanded services that the county would offer as part of this new strategy to help people get out of homelessness. And Matt Piper, bringing you back into this, you wrote about a meeting that took place yesterday between the two mayors and House and Senate leaders at the state legislature. Some of this has to do with what's happening with money from potential Medicaid expansion in the state. Is that right?
Yeah. So Mayor McAdams says, if you want me to commit to closing the road home and we get these other four shelter sites online, then we have to do something. We have to have some kind of infusion of resources in the meantime to draw down the homeless population as these other shelters are being built. And one idea that he had is that maybe you could use some of the $30 million that the state set aside in matching funds for Medicaid expansion passed during last year's general session. That would that was sort of had this population in mind, right? It sort of had 9,000 to 11,000 Utahns, many of whom are likely in the homeless population or would be at risk of becoming homeless. He said, as we head into a new administration, we're still waiting for federal approval, but there's nothing stopping us from using these state funds that we've set aside. To that, Speaker Hughes said, it's not so simple as that, but that he has not totally dismissed the idea of seeking some of those funds to help get the county on board with that goal that is obviously very much sought by the city.
Well, does everything hinge on having that money? I mean, in terms of making this new strategy work, having these smaller dispersed site shelters, does everything hinge on having additional, services, be they counseling or helping people get from, the street to shelter and then afterwards into homes? Is that all dependent on this money coming from the state?
It's such a huge portion of it. I mean, the county has its Pay for Success program that they announced, which is an initiative to improve services and get people out of emergency housing. But, I mean, you just look at the millions of dollars in play here. You've got $27 million coming from the state over 3 years, at least expected to come from the state over 3 years. They're looking for $50 million or $40 million to build these four new shelters. But that Medicaid piece, that's $100 million that was going to go toward at-risk populations. And that's such a huge component of this. If that's never seen, then, obviously you have to rethink some of your goals and your, the ability to reduce the population.
Well, Matt, before we let you go, the sort of crucial things that we're waiting to see resolved in this story then are whether or not the Simpson Ave site remains among the new shelter locations, if and when the road home shelter would be closed, and whether there's money for the services that the county wants to provide. Am I missing anything in that list?
No, I think that's probably it. As far as the big things at this point, obviously there's a lot more details to be worked out as we go through this, but right now that's the crux of it.
Salt Lake Tribune reporter Matt Piper, I know we've got to let you go and cover other meetings, but thanks very much for being with us today on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Paul Raleigh, we've heard criticism that the process to decide the selection of these sites wasn't open enough. But leaving that aside just for now, the intention is to do something revolutionary, to do something different, a new strategy to tackle a big problem. That is, of course, something I think that that many people would like to see done, that they would say is needed. Is the future bright, murky for tackling homelessness in Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County?
Well, I would call it murky. There are a lot of questions to be answered. Each of these four shelters that they're talking about, it will hold 150 people. There are over 1,000 to 1,100 people at the Road Home already, and there's an overflow there. And so, Mayor Biskupski has said that with these additional services that will come on, and some of the low-income housing programs and that sort of thing, that you won't need that many people. But that remains to be seen. I mean, you alluded to it, but I think one of the big questions here is the process and how transparent it was. And that's one of the things that's really got people upset, because they, when the announcement came, it was a surprise. Now, the mayor has said that, and her people have said that they had to do it that way so they wouldn't pit neighborhood against neighborhood. But, my colleague Robert Gerke wrote a column the other day all about this problem that Mayor Biskupski has and her tenure and not being transparent enough. And that seems to be an ongoing complaint with this new administration.
Well, at this point, for the site selection, it seemed, hindsight is 2020, and if you'd gone another direction, who knows how it would have turned out. But definitely an interesting story to keep following. Salt Lake Tribune columnist Paul Raleigh there. We are going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will turn to the lack of affordable housing in Utah. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined for the remainder of this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry, environment reporter Emma Penrod, and columnist Paul Raleigh. You can join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Dan Harry, the Trib reported this week that the number of poor Utahns who need access to affordable housing far outstrips the number or the available housing stock that is out there. This is according to a state report. What are the kind of numbers we're looking at here and in terms of this gap?
Well, the gap they've estimated is about 38,000 units statewide, that there are 38,000 more households that need affordable housing than there are available units. And, there are different definitions. Some of them get pretty technical, but the really deeply affordable housing counts as people who make 30% or less of the median annual income.
Okay.
And so we've got a lot of those people. Obviously, as the state report pointed out, most of those numbers are in the metropolitan area, the Wasatch Front area. But it's also a big shortage in rural Utah.
So we're talking about the shortage of affordable housing, but also this is a question of pay as well, what people are getting paid and how they are able to afford the rent that is out there, the market rent. I guess those are two separate questions, but where will the future of affordable housing come from? Where does that stock come from generally? Are there tax credits or?
Well, the state report doesn't really spell out how this problem is going to be solved, but it said, we need to start moving strategically to do something about it. And, using incentives from HUD, the federal government, has been a main driver of that in the past. And we don't know what this new administration will do. I mean, we're entering a whole new world, and there's a lot of talk in the Republican Congress about cutting the deficits and cutting the national debt. Is this one area they'll look to? I don't know. We're going to have to find that out. But without that federal money coming in, providing incentives for developers to build this kind of housing, it's going to be very tough to ever make progress on filling that gap.
A quote from the report that I think probably could be applied to anywhere, but it says, nowhere in Utah can a full-time worker earn minimum wage and afford a two-bedroom apartment at a full market rate. Paul Raleigh, people aren't getting paid enough to make ends meet. They probably also can't afford the place that they're renting, and that means they're one, just going back to an earlier story, they're one crisis away, maybe one medical crisis away or emergency from homelessness. What's the solution, Paul?
Well, they'll be okay once Donald Trump makes America great again.
That's the answer.
But there isn't really an answer to that. And now with this new administration coming in and there seems to be an animus towards minimum wage. You've got these people coming in now. You got the Secretary of Labor who has been very outspoken against, raising the minimum wage and that sort of thing. And so, it's a real problem, and that's true. A lot of people, I know highway patrol guys who work two or three part-time jobs as security guys just to make ends meet from their salary that they get from the highway patrol. I don't know what the answer is, and there doesn't seem to be, with this new administration coming in, I don't know if there's going to be a real desire to address that much. That maybe they just think people ought to have, part-time jobs, extra jobs, work harder, or whatever. I had a thing in my column today about Ben McAdams pushed for there was legislation last year on economic development projects, similar to the Facebook data center that ended up going elsewhere because of opposition. But there was legislation sponsored by Wayne Harper, the senator from Taylorsville, that McAdams pushed very hard. That would set aside 10% of these big economic development projects for low-income housing. Senator Harper is going to propose legislation this next session to repeal that, because there's been a lot of pushback with the idea that that economic development and low-income housing are two separate issues and shouldn't be melded together.
Well, and it seems like, we talked about the solutions, but one of the solutions that's recommended by this report is some sort of tax credit for the construction of low income the refurbishment maybe of housing stock. That's got to come from the legislative level. But what you're describing is kind of an animus towards that.
Right.
It's interesting stuff. Let me throw out another quick reminder to listeners that we want to hear your thoughts on the stories that we're covering. The number to call is 801-355-8255, or you can comment at sltrib.com. Let's move on to some other stories from this past week. And Emma Penrod, environment reporter, you wrote a couple of days ago about a lawsuit filed by an environmental group. This is the Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. This was a lawsuit against some television personalities. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so the Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, this is a group for doctors, healthcare professionals who have an interest in a healthy environment, as they say, but in particularly they're concerned about clean air. That tends to be their biggest point. And they have been aware, they tell me, since about 2007 that there are various auto shops around the Wasatch Front where you can take a truck or on any other vehicle, hypothetically, but usually a truck, and have them remove the federally mandated pollution systems out of those trucks so that, and then they add other modifications which enable you to, software and things. And then you have a button basically somewhere in the truck that allows you to emit these plumes of smoke at will. This is a violation of federal law. It's not really allowed, but apparently it's been being done, and they were aware of this. In 2011 or thereabouts, they tell me, they were made aware of some YouTube videos from this group called the Diesel Brothers, showing people how to do this and demonstrating it with their own vehicles, which they would make and then turn around and sell. So they have, initially they you know, contacted this group and said, if you don't stop making these vehicles, we will sue you. They said that basically went nowhere. So this week they filed suit.
And this group, the Diesel Brothers, you said YouTube videos. Don't they have a cable television component to them as well?
Yes, they star in a reality television show also called The Diesel Brothers on the Discovery Channel. I understand that it has a second season coming up.
And so we haven't seen charges brought against anybody for these kinds of modifications. Or how, I guess, I don't know if your reporting has covered this, but is this a regular... I guess a kind of charge that you would see regularly brought against anyone.
This is called a citizen suit. This is something that's allowed under the Clean Air Act, which permits regular individuals, anyone really who has the money and the desire to do so, to bring a suit against somebody who has violated clean air rules if they can demonstrate that their violations of those rules caused harm to those individuals. So a lot of the complaint in the suit is, the Utah physicians saying, well, they've contributed PM2.5 to our airshed, they've contributed to the formation of ozone in our airshed, and as a result, we experience these days of poor air, which are damaging to our health and which, inhibit us from being able to live the kind of lifestyle we want to live. To demonstrate, that they have been harmed by, this behavior.
You also wrote about diesel in particular being essentially worse when it comes to the kinds of pollutants that are being emitted in your article.
With diesel vehicles emit more emissions, generally speaking, than gasoline vehicles.
Right. I haven't seen the show. I haven't seen the YouTube videos. What are these, I guess you could call them reality TV stars or personalities. What do they have to say about this suit, or have they responded?
They have declined to comment.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting suit.
And motorized version of Duck Dynasty, I think.
The motorized version of Duck Dynasty. It's an interesting story, and I wonder, do we know what happens? The suit has to be accepted and then brought to court.
Yeah, it's a federal lawsuit. They will... right now we're waiting, for a response from the Diesel Brothers. They'll respond, they'll go to court, and the judge will decide, if this is something where they're going to award damages to the Utah physicians for having been harmed by, these alleged actions.
Okay. Also this week on the environment front, you wrote about the fears of some climate scientists out there in Utah. Over the incoming Trump administration, and in particular fears pertaining to the suggestion by some in the incoming administration that they would defund the climate research part of NASA's budget.
Mm-hmm.
What was said and why the fears, and who did you speak to?
Yes, yeah, so the concerns arise from an advisor to the Trump administration telling the Guardian newspaper that they didn't feel like it was NASA's place to be pursuing climate research, and that they thought maybe that research would be better somewhere else in some other administration. So it would be a shifting maybe of the funds from NASA to another source. But there are numerous scientists and students in Utah and other institutions in Utah that receive funding directly through this arm of NASA. And as one professor at BYU pointed out, NASA is primarily responsible their Earth science system is primarily responsible for funding research related to, detecting the weather from space, or from that kind of monitoring standpoint. It's as he said, they develop the technology that is used by other scientists then to collect information about the weather and study the climate and these sorts of things. So the people who are worried about being impacted are the people who develop these technologies, as well as the people who, potentially use them, who are worried that if new technologies aren't, brought online, or that if things aren't maintained properly, that they will eventually lose access to NASA's satellites.
Yeah, and that's one aspect of this is the Earth-observing satellites that NASA mm-hmm. has, and I don't know who it was. I checked out the Guardian article, but saying that the Trump administration thinks NASA should be looking at deep space and not observing Earth. Paul Rawley, a dismissal of climate scientists. Donald Trump has called climate change a hoax, or at least he did in his campaign. An anti-science take, I guess, on research in the coming years.
Well, it's a Chinese plot to destroy America's economy.
Right.
But, I mean, you know, you look at the Trump administration coming in, and that attitude is consistent with a lot of other things. It's, you know, it seems to be very, you know, pro-business, pro-development, you're going to possibly have a Secretary of State who was, head of Exxon, and you know, their whole thing is drilling and extracting natural resources. And so, yeah, they would be opposed to any idea of regulations that would stop that. And the whole administration seems to be like that, or, coming in. It's interesting. You're seeing some pushback. I mean, there was not too long ago, Jerry Brown, the governor of California, said if they do that California will set up its own monitoring system and its own satellite. And I mean, what is California, about the sixth largest economy in the world now or something? But it'll be interesting to see what happens. But this is consistent with the whole attitude of the Trump administration. I think people are going to start realizing what they're in for over the next 4 years.
Wasn't there a moment in time where the incoming administration asked for a list of, maybe it was Energy Department officials who worked on climate change, who had worked on climate science? Anybody remember that?
Yeah, they did ask for it, and the department refused to supply it. Mm-hmm. And they said, we see this as a potential abuse of the civil service system and employee privacy rights, and we're not going to give you that list.
Making lists. Well, you know what? We're going to have to take another quick break right now on the show, but it's definitely worth checking out the coverage that's been done of these fears of climate scientists. Emma Penrod's reporting available at sltrib.com. Again, as I said, we're going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, we will we will look at calls from an outdoor industry leader's calls for the Outdoor Retailer Show to leave Utah. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Emma Penrod, and Paul Raleigh. Join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Dan Harry, the founder of Black Diamond Equipment, this week penned an op-ed in the Salt Lake Tribune and said that the outdoor retailer convention he helped bring to Utah a couple of decades back should leave the state. And in fact, he says they should leave in disgust. Why?
Right. Peter Metcalf said that Utah leaders have proven that they don't care about public lands, that they want to roll back monuments, that they want to defund federal public lands, that they want to open public lands to more extraction of natural resources, and that the attitude just demonstrated by Utah elected officials is anathema to what the industry should stand for, which is protecting and respecting and enjoying the beauties of nature. And, it's a bit of deja vu all over again,
right.
This is certainly not the first time that the outdoor retailers have threatened to pull out of Salt Lake City in Utah. They haven't done anything about it the several times that this has arisen. I think it's led to some pretty good meetings between the industry and elected leaders, particularly governors. It hasn't changed the rhetoric or the political attitude we see of elected leaders here.
Well, the leverage they have, the leverage that the Outdoor Retailers Convention has is a lot of direct
money.
Spending. Yeah, money coming into the state. How much money are we
talking
about?
They're estimating, and I don't know if I believe these estimates. A lot of times they use magnifiers and all of this stuff to estimate how much money it means, but they're estimating that the outdoor retailers it has two shows in Utah, one during the winter and one in the summer, and that they estimating it brings about $40 million to the economy. So that's a lot of money. The state is about, or purports to be about, economic development. So if this is a realistic threat, that's a big club to wield.
Part of the complaints from Peter Metcalf in his op-ed have to do with a movement toward trying to find a way to, quote-unquote, undo the recent designation of the Bears Ears National Monument by President Barack Obama. You know, Governor Gary Herbert responded to what, or at least his office responded to what Metcalf was saying. What did he say, or his deputy chief of staff, I guess, say?
Well, he said that Utah will always be a public land state, that they do respect the outdoors and the beauty of Utah's scenic wonders. He also made a comment, which kind of left me scratching my head, that the administration in creating monuments and imposing these protections didn't talk to the right people. Now, I don't know who exactly those right people are. It seemed like whether they agreed or disagreed, the administration did talk to local leaders. I mean, Sally Jewell came here. There were many conversations. The governor himself talked to the Interior Secretary numerous times, to the administration, and they disagreed, and the administration went ahead and created the monument. But they did, it's clear they did talk to them, and they did take their views into account. I mean, they shrunk what had been proposed as a 1.9 million acre national monument and made it a 1.35 million acre. That fit the configurations of lesser protection, but still protection that was proposed in Representative Rob Bishop's public lands initiative.
Which didn't get passed in Congress, but had it been passed, it would have been of a similar size.
A different kind of level of protections, but yeah, similar size. Mm-hmm.
The outdoor industry makes big use of public lands in the state. Paul Raleigh, Peter Metcalf says that by staying in Utah, they are complicit collaborators in their own demise, is the quote. There's often talk about industry influence on government. Will the outdoor retailers show have any impact on, say, a Rob Bishop or a Gary Herbert and what they want to do with public lands?
Well, I doubt it would have a lot of impact on Rob Bishop. He listens to the right people.
Whoever they are.
He's very in bed, for lack of a better term, with the extraction industries. He gets a lot of money from those donations from those areas. As I recall, I think that the outdoor industry convention is about the biggest.
It's the biggest convention.
In Utah, as far as what they bring in. There are a lot of ways to look at this and concerns. And of course, Gary Herbert is pretty much on board with the number of legislators who want to sue the federal government, get control of the federal lands and that sort of thing. Brian Maffley, our other environmental reporter, has had a couple of really interesting stories. And then I wrote a column with my own analysis about it, about what's going on in southern Utah with a certain company buying up all, going to auctions, CITLA auctions, and way outbidding everybody else to get CITLA land that's being auctioned off in close proximity to these protected areas. And it's called the Lyman Family Farms, and it was just recently, not too long ago, purchased by a guy, a millionaire who's got an air ambulance business. And then all of a sudden he puts up a gate transgresses a county road to keep people out, and a lot of people are wondering if what kind of sign this is, or what does that suggest if we start allowing more and more of this your private interests or whatever to get some of these lands.
Well, and especially to block access to otherwise public lands, correct?
Right. Huh.
In terms of part of this is also that the Outdoor Retailers Convention takes place in Salt Lake City, Utah, and a lot, I'm sure that a lot of the economic benefit takes place here for someone like Rob Bishop or someone in San Juan County. They're not seeing that driver. But Peter Metcalf in his op-ed points out that four of Utah's five national parks started, I think, as as national monuments like Bears Ears did, and those are used in official marketing campaigns by the state.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Yeah. The Mighty Five, I believe, is the marketing campaign.
Hmm. An industry flexing its muscle, we'll see if it has an impact and if they'll still be here. Their contract ends, Dan, in 2018?
2018, yeah. Well, you know, just one last note on that. You know, one sign that it is not having an impact is there was another story in the Tribune inside the A section today about Orrin Hatch meeting with Ryan Zinke, who right. is the designee for to become Interior Secretary. And Zinke is an interesting guy. He's very conservative. He's a Montana congressman, and he is he's conservative, but he also has taken a very strong and adamant stance against transfer of federal public lands to state control and ownership.
Right.
And you know, I think that this kind of alarmed some of the folks in Utah, and Hatch met with him to make sure, I think, that he's kind of on board with at least the ideology of Utah's push to transfer those lands, and also to try to, he said, repair the damage.
Yeah, right the wrong.
Yeah, and repair the damage of national monuments. I guess he's talking about economic damage there. Hmm. Which, you know, is far too soon to see if that occurs. If we look at what happened with the Grand Staircase, Escalante National Monument, which was designated 20 years ago, a couple of studies, different independent studies, have concluded that it didn't really have a notable negative or positive impact on the local economies.
Do we know the details of the meeting that Hatch and Zinke had? I mean, did he find an ally in Zinke in the end? Or?
Well, we didn't hear from Zinke. We heard from Hatch, and of course, he called him a promising ally. He also, while he was there, dropped off a bunch of letters of recommendation to appoint Representative Mike Noel, a state lawmaker, as head of the Bureau of Land Management. If that happens, you're really going to see outdoor retailers and other environmentalists scream bloody murder because of Mike Noel's position on public lands.
We are low on time here, guys, and I want to just get a couple of more stories in before we turn to our underplayed stories of the week. But Dan, just sticking with you a little bit longer, Utah Representative Chris Stewart just became the chairman of the House committee that oversees the Defense Department, but he's also purportedly being considered for a Trump cabinet post,
yeah.
right?
It's a subcommittee that he was appointed to of the Intelligence Committee, yeah. And he also has been interviewed and talked to, and there is some rumbling that he is under consideration as Air Force Secretary. He was in the Air Force himself. He was a pilot. We could see that he leaves that office. We don't know. We haven't heard anything more since the speculation. Apparently, there's some vetting going on right now, but we'll see.
Apparently, though, what happens to his seat if he has to vacate it is a little bit unclear under
right.
Utah law.
The Constitution says that a House member that leaves before his term of office ends will be replaced through an election. But state law doesn't spell out how that election occurs. Will there be conventions by the parties and primary elections? And will there be a general election that features a Republican and Democrat? None of that is spelled out in state law. So legislators who begin meeting in their annual session on the 23rd coming up here want to jump on this issue very quickly and spell out the details of it. Otherwise, it leaves all of those details to the governor, and I don't think they want the governor entirely controlling the process.
All right. Well, first, though, we have to see if Stewart gets selected for that post. Guys, we are out of time, and another hour has flown by, and we need to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And Dan, Harry, just I'll stay with you a little bit longer. Do you have an underplayed story picked out?
I'm just going to mention this Kirk Torgerson, who used to be a top lieutenant in the Attorney General's office, was arrested this week as a material witness in the John Swallow trial, the former Attorney General. And he was arrested because the prosecutor said that there was a fear that he would flee the country and not testify during the trial. Torgerson has denied this. And I got to say, a guy who was a career prosecutor in the Attorney General's office, to see his photo in the orange jumpsuit suit with kind of unshaven, you know, the mugshot with the handcuffs was pretty alarming.
It is. It's amazing. And a remarkable story at sltrib.com. That's Dan Harry's offer. Emma Penrod, what's your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week?
Among all this news about the Diesel brothers being sued and about Volkswagen, there was a notice of violation issued from the EPA to Fiat Chrysler for over 100,000 vehicles they say had software installed their 3-liter diesel engines that had software installed to make it look like they were emitting less emissions than they were under certain circumstances. All sounds very familiar if you're familiar with the Volkswagen case. But they're saying that they were in negotiations with the EPA and that they haven't done anything wrong and that the issue's been blown out of proportion. So
a denial.
We'll see how that goes.
Okay. That's Emma Penrod's pick. And Paul Raleigh, yours.
Well, a federal judge this week has refused to dismiss lawsuit against the NSA for allegedly illegal telephone surveillance in Utah during the Olympics. The feds wanted the lawsuit tossed out, but Judge Robert Shelby refused to do that, and that lawsuit will continue with the allegations of during the Bush administration there was illegal surveillance on citizens in the state of Utah.
Paul Raleigh's is a case moving forward. For mine, I think I'll go with the deal to purchase and leave undeveloped Bonanza Flats. This is below Guardsman Pass, which is after the summit of Big Cottonwood Canyon, and it connects with Wasatch Mountain State Park. It's a big deal, $38 million for 1,350 acres, a deal agreed on but not finalized. They're still trying to bring in all the money they need to make that happen. Salt Lake Tribune editor Dan Harry, environment reporter Emma Penrod, and columnist Paul Raleigh, thank you very much for joining us today. Many thanks as well to Matt Piper, who joined us earlier. But thanks, guys.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you.
We will wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Today, Kirby talks about the origin of his relatively new feature in the Trib, which he calls Disturbing History, and about why he feels the need to dig into the past.
I started it in part because I've always been interested in the history of where I currently am. Back when I had one, my therapist told me it was because I led such a fragmented life, geographically being in the military, that I tried to attach myself to places by learning the history about them. The history of Utah, specifically the area that I'm in, fascinates me because I want to know how things wound up the way they did, the way people thought. And if you can look back at human beings, say, 100 years ago, that are your people, you understand better how they got to where they are today. And racism is one of those things that really stands out because it's unacceptable in newspapers of today. I mean, we don't even go anywhere with the N-word. Mm-hmm. It's verboten. But it wasn't that long ago when it was used widely by people in Utah. And it wasn't, as I said in one column, it wasn't the virulent KKK, let's lynch them attitude. There was a casual racist attitude about people that they're gently our inferiors.
You know, looking at the decline or the, you know, the one-time prevalence of the use of racist language in newspapers compared to how it is today, does that just mean that the racism has gone beneath the surface?
I don't think so entirely. There's a general change in attitude about human beings in general. I think more and more you're seeing interracial couples more and more now than you would have ever seen before.
Right. There's actual changes from a societal level, even if including the fact that that, you know, the N-word's not being used.
Yeah, I was subjected to a very racist upbringing. Hmm. My family wasn't members of the Klan, but they definitely believed that blacks and Native Americans and that sort had something in their background that made them inferior to us. Well, I got a lot of that driven out of me by my parents, who were pretty intolerant of racism. And then my kids don't even really understand why we were that way. And my grandkids, hopefully, will be even better. at dismissing those things.
You know, in a column you wrote about some of the discrimination that was maybe church-sanctioned, and that that is kind of a mark that a strike that is difficult for the LDS Church to move into the future with, because it's always kind of there lingering in the background.
Well, our memory of history has gotten a lot longer. There were things that could be swept under the carpet back when everyone didn't have access to them. You could just change the subject and nobody could do anything about it because they didn't have access to counter arguments. That's not the same anymore. Hmm. It's, you know, people know stuff and they're not likely to forget it. It's going to be something that we have to live down for the rest of ever.
Hmm. Does that mean that there's a mandate to do more, or to combat it more, or to change more drastically? Or,
well, all of those would work. The question is how much do you want to own your mistakes? And sometimes that's harder for organizations than it is for individuals.
Is more of that happening? Is the from the organizational level, are you seeing more of a willingness for admitting mistakes of the past to occur?
Well, the essays that the church, the LDS Church, has posted on its website are indicative of a degree of openness. We haven't got all the way there yet, but I think it's an admission that we can't pretend stuff didn't happen anymore.
Hmm. All right, a first step.
Yes.
Find all of Kirby's columns at sltrib.com. That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and the Tribune's Emily Means. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.